This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Keeping the conversation going.
This is the Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
How are men and boys talking to each other about their bodies, and does it need to change? Is it more acceptable to talk about how a man looks than how a woman or girl looks? Hello, this is The Conversation Hour. I'm Mary Guerin, and yesterday I did ask you, when is it okay to talk about each other's bodies? We're talking about women and men. Today I want to hone in on men and boys. It seems to be the week for it. Ariana Grande, all of the talk about her yesterday, and there are highlights of the severe consequences of what can happen with men in particular through some ABC reporting today online. There's a piece about them becoming addicted to steroids. Media Watch this week highlighted the plethora of unregulated advertisements about unregulated peptides that's happening on social media, and a lot of that is driven by the surge in demand from men and boys who want to get big or change how they look. So we just wanted to continue the conversation today. Just as with girls and women, there are serious consequences to the words we use around men's bodies. Is it harder, though, to draw the lines, do you think, between complimenting a man or a boy about his body, his strength, and the difference between that and encouraging self-destructive behaviour or even just self-destructive self-images when it comes to men or boys? David from Ballarat rang me yesterday, and he told us that he feels okay on one hand when people tell him what's considered a compliment about having lost weight, but on the other hand, it did make him feel they were judging his previous shape. Men and women still with those complicated feelings about words. So I want to ask you today, how equipped are you as a man or as a boy to have a healthy conversation about bodies, body images? Are you any better or worse than a woman or a girl if you have a man or boy in your life? Do you have to change how you're talking to them about it? Have you thought about that? I'd love to hear your thoughts today. Let's carry on that conversation today. Also, who are the artists that introduced you to a brand new genre of music? One group that pioneered a style is in Australia this week for the first time in 16 years. That is Massive Attack with Teardrop. They are in Australia, as I said. Melbourne's show is sold out next week. Now, Massive Attack, a band of the 90s, no doubt many of you are saying, yes, of course, love them, and maybe you've got tickets. I'd love to hear from you. They're often credited with pioneering trip hop. So I want to ask you, who are the artists that introduced you to a new genre, whether it's trip hop or K-pop, or synth pop, or heavy metal, or glam, or punk, or classical, Britpop, yacht rock? Tell me, who are the artists that dragged you from your comfort zone and gave you a whole new world of music? Maybe it's Massive Attack to you. Maybe it's someone else. I'd love to hear from you. I am asking you about new genre of music. I'm also asking you about men and boys talking to each other about their bodies, or how we talk to them about their bodies. Menka in Sydenham, what did you want to say?
Hi. I just would like to say it's not about the gender. It could be him, her, or they, and who are comfortable talking about their body shape and, you know, comment and take compliment. And it could be they get offended. So I think it's not about gender. It's about the individual person, how they feel, how they take it, and how sensitive they are talking about their body shape and all.
That's right. And, of course, it's what is in our brains and our vulnerabilities and our backgrounds as well, Menka, as to what we take or bring to a conversation about that. Do you think that men or boys...
Sorry, I cut you off because you reminded me of my grandma. If my grandma see me slim, she said, "Oh my poor girl, you are so slim. It feels like your family is not feeding you, so you need to eat more butter." So it's culture, definitely.
Oh, Minka, I just love your grandmother. Just hearing about her, that's a really good point. Thank you, Minka. Is it about gender? Is it not about gender? Do you agree with Minka? I'd love to hear from you. Does the male perspective, which of course has traditionally, for many good and economic reasons, been all about strength and size. How do we take that in 2026? If you're a man or a boy, or you have loved ones who are men and boys, I'd love to hear from you. Trent in Lower Plenty, what do you think? Hi.
Hi there. I don't know, traditionally what my peers regard to be as... the edifice of a man and a shape and a size and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found compliments based on what I look like to feel redundant.
What do you mean by that?
Well, we're all just born with the body that we have. We haven't earned it. We've just been gifted a certain amount of genes and DNA and I don't know, there's just always been this expectation because of the way that I look that I'd act a certain way, that I'd have a certain level of athleticism, that I've been judged from the outside in rather than the inside out. And I've always found that part of hanging out with other men to be quite boring, to be honest.
Oh, that's interesting. Boring because, you know, you just don't gel with this image that they've got?
It's just that the stereotype just gets in the way of trying to project who you are on the inside based on stigma.
Mm. Trent, thank you so much for your thoughts. I just want to ask you about what we are seeing in the news, disordered body image and eating from men and boys. From your point of view, as someone who's obviously thoughtful about this, what do you think is going on for men and boys then? Do they lack that perspective of, look, it's just what you're born with?
It's tough. Being a taller male, I was always played basketball and was interested in athleticism in that regard. But it's tough. I've got two young boys of my own. They're 3 and 18 months.
How will you be talking to them about it?
Positive self-body image. I hope that they don't care that I'm tall, that they're taller or shorter than me in any regard. Just to try and deflect that the outside really has any importance at all as far as value.
Trent.
And I feel like my personality's been undervalued specifically because the way that I look.
Trent, that is so interesting. Thank you. Cuddle those boys for us. I'm sure you're a great dad bringing in that sort of perspective. Let's bring in Danny Rowlands, who is Director of Education Initiatives from the Butterfly Foundation, to talk about this. Danny, thank you for joining us. You joined us yesterday. We were talking more generally about the importance of words and attitudes when it comes to talking about each other's bodies to each other. What does the particular instance of being a man or a boy factor in the work that you do?
So it's been interesting to, I've been doing this work for over 20 years and noticing that there has been a large focus on girls and women, but over time we are obviously seeing all genders included, but increasingly also research and studies focusing on the experience of boys and men and what their relationship is with their body. We know that typically masculinity and muscularity has been very tightly connected, but we also know that the experience in the body and the pressures that are placed on particularly boys and men to uphold these ideals, which was beautifully explained before, these athletic ideals and these assumptions about muscle size, is absolutely playing a really significant role in how boys and men view their own body and how they feel they should be looking.
Mm. Denny Rollins is with you. She's from the Butterfly Foundation. Tell me what you think about how men and boys are processing body image, about whether men or boys are any better equipped to have healthy, non-toxic body images or conversations about their bodies. Danny, just for anyone who might be listening who's saying, look, 'twas ever thus, as Trent was saying, these things have been lionized. Men, boys grow up already internalizing a certain look. What is the difference now when, from the Butterfly Foundation's point of view, about the consequences and the environment we're living in right now for boys to be growing up in terms of the healthy, about the risks to their health that's out there?
Yeah, so there are obviously access to means, which is either supplementation, obviously an increase, which was mentioned earlier, to peptides and steroid use. But also what we're finding on the likes of social media is this really, really strong and emerging gym culture that is encouraging early introduction to strength training and weight training and the gym for boys in particular. So we actually know that this is a becoming more of a problem, but we're also raising more awareness. So we want more boys and men to understand that they're not alone if they're struggling in how they're feeling about their body. But also that often, typically for boys and men, the behaviours they engage in that might be actually restrictive eating or deemed as very disciplined, or their training behaviours, which may in fact be very rigid and extreme, kind of sit under a mask of well-being, but are heavily celebrated. And so it can really confuse developing and younger boys to understand, well, what is a positive relationship with my body? What does a balanced and positive relationship with training and eating actually look like for me? And they're too getting swept up in this movement around trying to chase these body ideals, which for boys is still that muscular ideal and that lean ideal, which for girls it still is moving towards that thin or that extreme thin ideal, as was discussed yesterday.
Mm. Danny Rollins is with me again today to look at this. It seems to be the week for looking at this topic, Danny.
Yeah.
When I have a young adult boy and I have a young adult girl, and they're both physically active and they both really enjoy that activity, and I hear them with particularly, not necessarily my son, but his group, you know, you're looking ripped, bruh. You know, how much of that is just innocent and harmless? We know yesterday we were even talking about, well, you can't even really say you look well potentially to a woman if it's got all these other bits and bobs attached to it, if you're only saying that if she's thin. How hard is it? Is it problematic to say you're looking ripped?
It's, you know, making compliments or giving someone feedback about how they look occasionally is part of our society and how we talk in, you know, we're very visual creatures, and often it's an icebreaker when somebody sees somebody or when they haven't seen somebody for a while, and it might be the very first thing that is said. We know how we talk to each other, you know, that about bodies can be a connection to each other, as I said, that icebreaker, but it also sometimes can be kind of an indirect way of people using it as an opportunity for them to talk about their own body or their own insecurities, or to validate, you know, have their body externally validated for either training behaviours or how they look. So it's actually pretty complex. So obviously we want boys and men to be talking to each other and to be connecting. It's so important. I've got a young son also, and that communication piece is really critical. But we also want to make sure that we're not overvaluing how a boy looks, particularly in early adolescence and during adolescence and adulthood. Like, so much is happening and changing in their body, and they're comparing themselves often to elite athletes or, you know, adults that they're accessing through content online. So we want to make sure that we're just supporting, but we're not again overvaluing and over celebrating these appearance ideals that have really been consistent for boys and men for decades and decades, if we even think Greek gods. And their body shape that they upheld. So this athletic ideal has existed for a long time. And so we do need to also just move away from that and, you know, acknowledge that boys and men can look many different ways, just like girls and women can too, and people of all genders.
Mm. Danny, women and girls have been talking about this for good reason for a long, long time, and it feels like it's a continuing conversation. We're not there yet, but it's a common conversation. Mm. This is relatively, I mean, it's relatively new in the sense of this sense of understanding how many boys are really falling prey and losing their lives at times to addictions along these lines. Are boys getting better at hearing these messages, or are the algorithms so strong that it is making that message harder to hear, in your opinion?
I think just there's a general movement with men being more open to hearing things about mental health, about well-being, about their feelings and emotions, and there's lots of work being done in the mental health and health sector to be able to do that, to increase that conversation. So it's, I guess, you know, it's important that we understand that it's a point in time, and where all the work that we're doing at Butterfly is about increasing and raising awareness, and also making it okay for boys to be saying, I'm actually struggling with this and these illnesses are affecting us as well. And more research and studies are being done into understanding the experience for boys and men. So it's a time of awareness raising in particular, and also education, so that we can hopefully early identify and not just celebrate behaviours or just dismiss something because perhaps it's a boy or it's a man. And they wouldn't be experiencing an eating disorder or body image concerns. So it's, again, just kind of allowing us to open ourselves up and think these are human beings, and anyone who's living in a body can have a whole range of experiences with that and can also be vulnerable to developing disordered eating or an eating disorder.
Mm. And going back to Trent's point of view, I don't know if you heard that, Danny, but Trent was saying as a bigger bloke, a taller bloke, muscular bloke, I think he was saying he's expected to be a certain type of thing. I remember there were texts yesterday saying, well, if you're short, also potentially as a bloke, you know, you get that comment as well. What do you have to say, I guess, like we were talking about yesterday, when you're greeting someone, is this something that men and boys should be thinking about, just changing their language about how they compliment people?
Absolutely. And it just goes, it's for all human beings. Like, can we just say, hey, great to see you, or wow, it's been a while, or what have you been up to, and you know, oh, love your jacket, or whatever it is, if we want to make some kind of appearance based comment. But you know, it is important to know that particularly for boys and men, teasing and bullying about their weight, but also their height or their muscularity or lack thereof, is actually a really significant influence on men, the behaviours they engage in with training, with eating, and actually increase their risk of developing disordered eating or an eating disorder. So how we are talking about boys and men, their bodies, how they look, what we are celebrating, what we are putting worth and value on, is really important. So if we can just kind of be mindful of the way we're talking about bodies, and also to men, and realise, you know, that they're human beings, they're sensitive, we're trying to encourage particularly this, you know, these generations, earlier generations or younger generations, to really connect in and know that, you know, if they're struggling, they need to talk about it, and that they're a human being, and that they're going to have all the feelings and emotions too, and that's okay, and they're allowed to have them, but also that support exists for them also.
Danny, thank you for joining us again. It's an ongoing conversation. Really happy for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
That's Danny Rollins, who's Director of Education Initiatives at the Butterfly Foundation. And remember that there is a helpline, a national helpline, 1-800-334-673. That's 1-800-334-673. Or just look online for Butterfly Foundation as well. Kylie says, other people's bodies are none of your business. Any gender, don't comment. Even if you think you're being complimentary, you don't know what's going on in their minds. It is tricky, isn't it? Because we are undoing the habits. Please keep those calls coming. 1300 222 774. I'd love to hear what you have to say. Jane from Narre Warren, you wanted to say something?
Oh, yeah, hi. I just listened to Trent before and really struck a chord with me in a totally different way. After I had my babies, I happened to lose the weight pretty easily, actually. Like, you know, I was doing all, you know, trying to be healthy, trying to exercise. And, you know, what happened to me was postpartum went through, you know, depression and anxiety. But what I found was is that people were just commenting about my appearance. Yeah, you look great. Wow, you know, can't believe you've had three kids. How'd you do it?
What did you say, Jen?
And so, but the thing is, in my mind, I was really in a bad place. Mm. And I felt really judged.
Yeah,
like
wow.
It was just, people were actually trying to be, well, being genuine and paying me a compliment. But it was so irrelevant to where I was actually at.
Yeah. And so, so in looking back, you've obviously thought about this, Jane. What do you think people should be saying or should be doing? Is it just about, look, how are you, Jane? You know, how are you sleeping?
How are you managing? Are you getting enough rest?
Yeah.
Do you need any help? Can I make you a meal? What's it like having a new baby? Like, how's it going? Like, just stuff like that.
Yeah. Jane, thank you. Terrific insights, and I remember similar experiences. And as I said yesterday, I am changing how I'm talking. Some of this just comes out of our mouth because it is part of our culture. Let me know if you are a man or a boy as well. You tell me. I'm not one. You tell me what it's like. 1300 222 774. Let's carry on that conversation in the conversation hour. But also later, I want to be hearing about what artists introduced you to a new genre. I'm already getting things by text, but I'd love for you to call up. Maybe we'll play a little bit of the artists that you are naming. 1300 222 774, because Massive Attack is in Australia. We'll talk about them. Maybe you're going to the concert next week. I'd love to hear about your thoughts about them. Also, though, we will be keeping up with what is happening with the release of IBAC's Operation Richmond. If you haven't caught up with that, we'll get Richard Willingham. He's been digesting it in the past hour or so. But next, what do you think about Jetstar's new carry-on rules? Have you heard about this? How will it affect you? And particularly, what will it mean for you if you have medical needs? That's next.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, have you heard Jetstar has a new rule from February next year, which effectively halves the number of carry-on items that you're allowed to just guide us through this. Chris Saponi is aviation writer with The Age. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you, Mary.
So essentially what it's saying is you have to pay if you want that all-important slot above your head and to put your bag in there.
Well, yes. The thing is you have to pay for access. So so what that means is if you are getting on the plane and you want to have access to the overhead bins ahead of anyone else, you need to pay. So basically, if you want to have a good chance of getting one of those spaces in the overhead bins, you have to pay for that. You could take your chances and not pay and then get on board after everybody else who's paid for this is boarded and see if you can find a slot. But it really sort of adds to that kind of Hunger Games feeling of, you know, boarding a plane.
Hunger Games on Jetstar. How do you feel about that? 1300 222 774. What's our flight even paying for these days? 1300 222 774. How's it going to affect you in particular? I'd love to hear what you generally have to put underneath your feet or overhead and not check in. How does it affect your life? Chris Saponi is all through this. He's an aviation writer with The Age. Chris, we're going to be talking soon about what it means for people with medical needs or accessibility issues. Can we just go to that very quickly? I haven't seen much detail this morning from Jetstar about this. There seems to be talk that there will be carve-outs, but what do we know?
Well, I mean, those should be established under existing rules. The one thing that I picked up when Jetstar and was putting out information on this yesterday is that, and this isn't for medical needs, but it's for families. They said if people are traveling with babies, they will be given one free underseat space for the bag for the baby's needs, which is interesting. So they're aware that there are different needs based on different profiles of passengers. But I know that when it comes to mobility devices and it comes to the needs of, you know, particular needs of people with medical issues, that is something that's also being taken up in the current aviation consumer reform that's in Parliament. So I think that would ideally cover it, but it's nothing that Jetstar has addressed in this particular announcement.
So still just to sort of suss that out, is that potentially why they only made these rules from beginning of next year, just to iron out some of these inevitable bits of feedback they're going to get?
Well, yeah, and I think they're also just looking ahead. I mean, for them, the issue is, you know, they present this as a new option, but the reality is they're going to make more money off of it. Basically, they're charging you for something that you used to have free when you got on a Jetstar plane. So that, I think, is the real impetus. They're looking at their costs, and Jetstar is all about keeping costs low, and this is another way to raise revenue. And they're looking across the over to Europe, and they're seeing what they do over there, and they're just sort of emulating that here locally.
Before I let you go, Chris, this on text, they should just make check bags free and charge for carry-on. That would solve it. I'm not sure about that as a particular idea that they'll take on, but is this, I mean, we've seen obviously the real Hunger Games overseas where you're, and I have done this, run towards the flight so that you could possibly get not the worst seat on the planes. Are we getting closer to that with Jetstar? Is that too far because Australians won't accept it or because it doesn't have that sort of cut price pressure yet? Is this a tiny step towards the horrible extreme?
Well, unfortunately, I think it may be. I mean, I think the fact that they're pointing to what say like Ryanair does in the UK as an example is telling. And it's basically just charging for every aspect of the flight, everything except for the flight itself. They're finding a way to charge for. And you know, you kind of train your passengers to get used to this. It can be infuriating. And yet they also point out that they've kept ticket prices low. I mean, when you think about it, ticket prices are incredibly low for a low cost carrier over the years, given how much everything else is rising in price. But what's happening is they're stripping away all the things that you used to get as an inclusion in your ticket if you're traveling 20 years ago.
Mm. Chris Saponi, thank you for joining us today.
Mary, thank you.
Chris Saponi, aviation writer with The Age. Susan from East Gippsland, you wanted to talk about travel?
Yes, thanks. Sorry, I just did a weekend trip away interstate. Was fine on the way going there with carry-on baggage. Ended up buying a football team scarf and two small trinkets for children. Mm-hmm. And ended up, before we boarded to come home, the Jetstar ladies were looking at people and picking up their baggage and weighing their baggage. And combined with my husband's, we were 200 grams over.
Oh.
No, and we got charged $85.
Oh. 200 grams over, and was that the 7-kilogram limit, I think?
Yes, but that's not the argument, okay?
Couldn't you have put the scarf on, is what I'm thinking, but go on, Susan, yes.
But the argument is, we, as passengers, we don't get weighed to get on that aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So someone might be 100 kilos, someone might be 75 kilos. Is there an assumption that we all weigh a certain amount to get on that plane? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, I hear what you're saying, Susan. I'm picking up what you're putting down. In fact, I'm suggesting in my mind now that if we can prove that we've lost weight recently, then we get on that plane with extra baggage.
No.
What do you think?
No. I don't mean that. I'm just saying that it's not even considered. Squabbling about a small amount of the extra carry-on. Okay, well, I was over. Paid it without, murmuring anything. But my husband said, this is madness. You've got everybody here with different weights and no one's
looking at it.
That's not a consideration.
Yeah. Susan, thank you. That's a really horrifying experience there. And I'm sorry about that. Oh, $80 for 200 grams. Also, this on text, I'm 6'4", where should I even put my legs? Now, there's that about the inconvenience and the cost, but also when it comes to people with accessibility issues, that's pretty serious. We've got Associate Professor Lisa Stafford on the line. who is ARC Future Fellow in Transport Equity with Inclusive Futures. That's at Griffith University. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us. Chris Saponi was saying that we're not exactly sure what it means for people, for instance, with medical needs. What do you think from your reading of Jetstar's changes?
Thanks so much, Mary, for just opening up this conversation about, I think, the implications. And I think most of us have all been caught out seeing the media release. And my first thought was, have Jetstar actually engaged with people with disabilities and the chronic illness communities to understand what these impacts are? And while, yes, the aviation white paper, you know, put some protections in place, that still hasn't come in place. And, you know, there's a lot to be thought through, because as we all know, carry-on bags isn't just like a luxury. Like, carry-on bags has so much, you know, there has some really important essential items in place for many of us. I think we all can relate to putting our medication on board and health equipment, change of clothes, all these things that are really critical, but for people with disabilities essential. What does that look like? How is it even going to be managed when the process we know is already so complicated for people with disabilities?
Lisa, that's what I was going to say. It's a bit of a straw camel's back situation. As it stands already, how difficult is it to have accessibility catered for in Australian Airlines?
Well, the Disability Royal Commission in November 2022 actually held a specific workshop on air travel because of the significant reported lived experience of discrimination people with disabilities face. Like, it's such a complicated journey that, you know, from trying to book your tickets to having to be well ahead of check-in, well before everyone else, you're having to wait, you've got to board before everyone else, you've got to sit on board, wait to actually be, you know, wait for everyone else to get off, and then hopefully, you know, they'll turn up. It's such a complex process already. And I just think, how will Jetstar ensure they're not adding financial time and emotional load burden, which we already know exists for people with disabilities with this choke process, you know? Because it's real. Like, they just mentioned a small backpack, laptop and a handbag's allowed underneath. Like, what does that look like? And then you think about the staff. Like, how are they going to manage that? It's already, if you go to different airports, a different experience. And regional areas alone, you know, this is a further impact for regions. So I can imagine how that's managed, knowing that I fly region. So there's all these complications. Like, and also, like, I think personally even, like, I use a power wheelchair myself, and I have to take my batteries on board. And while that's not charged at the moment, my batteries are long. Like, they have to come on board. They can't go underneath. They're 55 centimetres. I have to have a 60-centimetre bag. Now, under their rules, my bag's not even allowed to go on, even if I want to pay for access. And I think Chris mentioned really well, he put this, like, we're paying for access, but some of it, like, that's just like the inequality that is actually going to be presented for so many people. And I just feel like Jetstar haven't read the room here, like, when we think about already the significant cost of living people are experiencing. So this is another cost burden on people when they haven't reduced their ticket price, have they?
Well, that's right. They're saying it's keeping them low. Lisa, I want to dig into this topic more, but thank you so much for leaning in this morning. I think we should take a wider look at the sector as well. But thank you.
No, thank you so much. Much appreciated. Thanks, Mary.
That's Associate Professor Lisa Stafford from Griffith University. You're on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. And Alison has got in contact with us about an issue that she's had. Alison, you use a wheelchair and you've had some problems when you tried to get to the AFLW match. Is that right?
So I'm going with my friend who uses a wheelchair.
All right.
And so I was like, cool, I'll pop online, I'll book the tickets, easy peasy. And so I go onto the Ticketmaster website and they're like, it was very confusing. It was like, you click on the little wheelchair and it says some venues may have tickets available, otherwise you'll have to call this number. And it seemed that Victoria Park didn't have a ticket I could buy online. So I called the special accessibility ticket line for Ticketmaster. And that took 45 minutes to try and book these tickets. Because the person I was talking to just had no idea how accessibility worked at Victoria Park.
And the person from the original person, or then the person you got onto, didn't know?
Well, the accessibility line. I only spoke to one person, and I'm like, isn't it your job to know how this works? And
so, what happened after the 45-minute wait and the conversation?
Well, I did have to be put on hold for a while they talked to someone. And then eventually I got my tickets SMS to me and they said accessibility area. And I was kind of, I was just like, I was still not exactly convinced that I had the tickets that I need, because on the phone I was like, would there be a chair for me to sit in next to my friend? And she was like, the staff will tell you what to do at the venue. And I'm like, you don't sound very confident. And then, oh, sorry, go on.
No, it's just I'm just flabbergasted. That was the sound of being flabbergasted Alison. So in the end, what's happened? You've got a ticket for your friend and it's just up in the air. What's happening with you?
Well, now I'm not even sure, because my wife called like Collingwood HQ to be like, how does it work? And then the person on the phone who was very helpful, they said, oh, you don't need to book an accessible ticket for Victoria Park. You can just rock up. And I'm like, well, now I don't know. It's been 2 days.
So when is this game, Alison?
It's on the 23rd of August.
Of August. I would love to hear back from you, Alison. We'll keep your number and just see what happened, because that's not a great story. And maybe we can try and get some reaction as well there from Ticketek and Ticketmaster. Alison. Yeah. Thank you for getting in contact. It's always really good to get an insight. We're talking about Jetstar. We're talking about accessibility. Really should be easier in so many parts of our lives. You are with The Conversation Hour, 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Look, hopefully we will get to Rich Willingham, who has been busy digesting what's happened with Operation Richmond that dropped this morning. That's the IBAC report. You will have heard about it. He can explain it and tell it what he's found in that big report. But coming up next, 1300 222 774. I want to hear from you. You're texting in, but I want to hear you call. Who are the artists who introduced you to a new genre, who dragged you from your comfort zone and put you into a whole new world? I want to hear about that, because the people who apparently invented trip hop, they're not happy with that description. Massive Attack is in Australia, but this is our entree to a chat about who introduced you to classical, yacht rock, K-pop, the whole deal, Zydeco in my case. I'll tell you all about it. That is next on The Conversation Hour.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Before we get to Massive Attack and the bands that dragged you into a new genre of music, there's been a massive report, Operation Richmond, a major anti-corruption investigation led by Victoria's IBAC, finally out this morning. Richard Willingham has had his head deep in all of the pages, and he was with Raf this morning, but he's digested even more since then. He can tell you what he has found. Hi, Rich.
Hello, Mary.
Tell us, what are the things that are standing out to you after you've had, you know, more than a moment to potentially look at it? Just 2 moments.
Only 2 moments. Had to go and hear Peter Marshall give his response too. And we'll get to that in a bit, because that was quite something, quite colourful. Mm-hmm. Essentially, the top line things you need to know is that there was no finding of corrupt conduct, but the IBAC raised serious concerns about the way that Peter Marshall behaved, senior ministers, including Gavin Jennings and Lisa Neville, former ministers, Daniel Andrews behaved, and how public servants also behaved. And basically they failed to follow their own guidelines, their own code of practices in getting a deal done with the union. So this goes back to 2016. Some of you may remember a long protracted pay dispute between the union and the CFA. Daniel Andrews promised in 2014 an opposition to fix it. Comes to office, Jane Garrett, given emergency services, she's trying to fix it. Then she says that the proposal from the UFU is just not workable, and they couldn't get a deal done. Daniel Andrews then effectively loses confidence in her to get a deal done. Asks Gavin Jennings, his sort of left hand man, to go and get a deal done. And this is where it gets interesting. So Gavin Jennings basically goes and negotiates one on one with Peter Marshall, the UFU secretary. Mm-hmm. He used a deputy secretary from the department to help with this process. but Cabinet was sidelined, Jane Garrett was sidelined, none of them knew this was happening. Then the proposal arrives at Cabinet and they force it through. And the report found that Peter Marshall was given extraordinary access and influence over senior members of the government and public service to get his deal done. Again, no finding of corrupt conduct. Peter Marshall was, you know, able to wield this influence. It suggests there were complaints that he threatened people. He denies this. Then later it says that he was able to sort of wield influence by suggesting who he'd like to be for FRV commissioners. He employed a member of the crossbench's child as a staff member when there was a very tense vote on fire services reform. Peter Marshall says he's done nothing wrong. He took this to the High Court, and he says the High Court found that IBAC was acting outside its jurisdiction on some matters. Mm. Eventually, we did see this come to light. It's quite a lengthy report. It recommends strengthening and publishing some of the ministerial codes of conduct. It's interesting to know that Tony Bates, the Deputy Secretary, who was sort of part of this little cabal that was designed to go and circumvent Cabinet and get a deal done, he's now the Department of Education's Secretary. So the top of the Education Department, and we understand, I think the Premier said this morning that he's now on leave, and there will be questions over how that is resolved. Mm. Now I should get to Peter Marshall, right?
Please do.
So he's been a decades-long Secretary of the United Firefighters Union, quite a sort of firebrand, pardon the pun, Mary. I know you love puns.
Yeah, thank you.
Leader of the union.
You're on fire.
Now he's given. Thank you. He has given a press conference a short time ago and has just railed against IBAC, says its powers are unfair. There was nothing IBAC ever did about all the leaks that were coming out of IBAC about the report that was being played through the media. He says he's been exonerated, you know, 8 years for nothing, 8 years and no finding of corrupt conduct, and yet all his text messages and phone calls were all tapped. Some of them were published in the report. He says there needs to be an investigation to IBAC. And the key thing is, Mary, he says he regrets nothing. He says he was standing up for his members and was out after an outcome.
After all that, Rich, thank you so much for bringing us up to date. I know that you'll still be pouring through it. I really appreciate you letting us know.
I should have said that Peter Marshall was trying to hose down the severity of this case. And I'll leave you with that, Mary. Goodbye.
Yeah, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Richard Willingham. Keep on all of the platforms, online, TV and radio, to keep up with Richard's analysis of that developing news today, as well as all of the ABC News team. And on 774, of course. Now, we are talking today on The Conversation Hour, and you've already got some suggestions on text, but I want to have you call 1300 222 774. The bands that got you over the line into a new genre. Because we're talking about Massive Attack, apparently invented trip-hop. I need to know about that. I've got someone in the studio who will explain it to me. Jody in Brunswick, you're going to the Massive Attack sold-out concert, are you?
I certainly am, and I feel very grateful to have landed a ticket and to be going with some close friends for some music that we share together, and it's so important to all of us.
You've been a fan from the get-go?
Yeah, back in the 90s, yeah. So there's lots of tracks that bring up lots of emotions and memories. So, yeah, there might be some tears, I think.
Might be tears. What do you remember when you think of their music? How did it sort of relate to you in your life?
Just connecting with who I was, or who I was becoming when I was a teenager, and just, I don't know, sharing experiences with friends that connected through the same type of music that weren't sort of always the mainstream crowd.
Yeah. Jody, have fun. There'll be many people who are listening who are so jelly at the moment. Enjoy that. And to everyone who is following along with Massive Attack, here's a little burst. Massive Attack, as Jody said, the soundtrack to that part of her life, and for many of us as well, but also potentially got you into trip-hop. Whatever that is, as I say, I'm going to find out. Who are the artists that introduced you to a new sound? I'd love to hear from you, whether it's trip-hop, whether it's classical, whether it's K-pop. 1300 222 774. Al Newstead is Double J's music and pop culture reporter and sitting with me in the studio. Lovely to see you, Al.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Have you got a ticket?
I do, yes,
you're
thankfully.
You're like Jody. You'll be there with Jody.
Very lucky, yeah.
And as I say, I've confessed my ignorance. I do want to hear from people who know that they've gone into a new genre of music through a band. I'd love to hear what it was. Was it Massive Attack? 1300 222 774. Just on that, you talk in an article online about Massive Attack's significance, and in particular this trip-hop, as I've mentioned. Now, I'm underinformed. Tell me what it was and whether the band liked this.
Yeah, they weren't always comfortable with the label, but I think with a lot of genres, it's just a way, you know, like a shorthand in a lot of ways. And they've sort of said, like, we never liked that label. We always just sort of as Massive Attack sound, you know. Mm. And I think that's across the board. Most artists kind of, you know, rumple when it comes to being categorized or pigeonholed. But
what did it mean?
Well, the term came about because they're from Bristol and they were a part of a collective in the late 80s, like a sound system collective. So DJs, graffiti artists, producers, and they were really mixing that Port Town's history for Jamaican music, post-punk, but then also combining that with what was emerging in dance music trends and in UK rap as well, putting all of that into a melting pot. And what they had was kind of the dub, the hypnotic sounds, the bass heavy beats, sampling, the omnivorous sampling of hip hop, but mixing that with soul. And as you heard there in that track, Unfinished Sympathy, basically mixing soul with kind of these loops and beats. And what that created was, yeah, this new sound that they would have, which was originally called the Bristol Sound, because that's where they were, and another act, Portishead, who another sort of pioneering trip hop group. And, yeah, that label came about and it just became an easy way to label it.
1300 222 774, ring us if you're a Massive Attack fan, and also if you want to tell us about that group that brought you over the line when it came to discovering a new genre. You're listening to Al Newstead, who, of course, you know from Double J, who's music and pop culture reporter. So with Massive Attack, I listened to that and I said, I don't know Massive Attack, but I heard those tracks. And of course, they really were everywhere. How significant is their coming to Australia after 16 years?
I mean, that long, it's a big deal. And they actually haven't released an album in that time either. They've had some EPs, some very politically driven work in recent years, and they have been active touring. But I think it's that they've kind of maintained this legacy and respect because they're such a foundational group for that sound. And their first three albums in the 90s, running from Blue Lines in 1991 through to Mezzanine in 1998, they're still widely regarded as some of the best and most influential records of that period. You know, everyone from Radiohead to Björk, even Gorillaz, kind of credit those albums for really kind of opening up the sound, and particularly in Britain, what was going on there, you know, it sort of really did have sparked this movement just before Britpop, just before electronic music was really breaking, where people were looking to England for fresh sounds and fresh appearances. So I think they just have never sullied that legacy. Maybe sometimes to their best attempts, have never sullied that legacy. And, you know, as we heard from Jody before, people really connect to that era and that really exciting period where, yeah, it really was dominated by global. And even if you've never listened to a Massive Attack album, I would argue you'd recognize some of their biggest songs.
Yeah.
Songs like Teardrop featuring Liz Fraser from Cocteau Twins is just iconic, I think, really transcended that scene and sound.
Yeah. Tell me what you think of Massive Attack or any group that dragged you into another genre. 1300 222 774. You say that they didn't sully their legacy, but it's interesting they haven't shirked from controversy, on the other hand, as well. They do have social causes. They're activists politically, just recently banned in Singapore.
Last week, banned in Singapore. So they have long been critics of Israel's military campaign in Gaza, you know, long before we've seen it being just a constant in our news feeds in the last few years. But yes, they played in Singapore last week and they were banned after bringing on a Palestinian flag on stage. There were chants of Free Palestine, which they say they didn't incite, but very happily joined in. And yeah, they've basically taken on the chin, being like, fine, if this is what it takes to be banned from a country, this is what we do because this is what we believe in. They've been fiercely anti-war. They were critical of the, you know, the Iraq War in the 2000s. I think their last EP kind of says it all. They had title tracks like hashtag climate emergency and hashtag universal income. So they've never, ever been shy about their political stance. No. Yeah, it's always been a big part of their work.
So you might expect that to be part of the reception in Australia or part of the picture of their Australian appearances.
They'll definitely speak to it. Yeah, absolutely. Yep. You know, their most recent release was with Tom Waits, famous American singer-songwriter. That was a deeply political protest song. The visuals on stage that they have for the tour, I'm sure, are absolutely going to be touching on that. Topics like state surveillance, you know, all of that. It's very much going to be part of the aesthetic.
Mm. Rachel in Abbotsford, are you seeing them as well? Hi, Rachel. You've nabbed some tickets.
Hi. Yeah, well, actually, we missed out on Melbourne tickets, so we're going quite to the extremes to see them. So we ended up getting tickets to Brisbane, so we're seeing them tomorrow night, so we're flying up tomorrow.
Wow.
But my partner, actually, she has to work, so she's actually having to go straight from the airport to the Brisbane Entertainment Centre. And we're just hoping that they're going to be late so she doesn't miss them, which and I saw them years ago at the Metro and they actually were 3 hours late. So I'm just hoping, maybe not that late, but
yeah, but that's playing into your partner's hands.
Yeah.
And why are they so important to you, Rachel, and to your partner?
Look, I think, like, you know, previous callers you've had, like, they were so seminal in the 90s. There's so many songs that just mean so much. You know, we've been playing them a lot over the last, since we got tickets. And, you know, they've never got old to me. The emotions are still there. I don't think I've been this excited in a very long time.
Good on you, Rachel. Well done. And, you know, if you're going to do the hard yards, then you've really deserved it. Al, you didn't have to fly there, but I hope you have a good time as well.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Definitely a bucket list moment to see Liz Fraser singing Teardrop, I think.
So she's here.
Yeah, apparently, yeah.
Right. She's any of the others wings as well? Any other featured artists, do we think?
Yeah, I'm assuming Horace Andy, Jamaican singer. I'd be very surprised if he wasn't there. Singer of Angel, many of their most famous songs as well. So, yeah, it's a collaborative effort. It's going to be fantastic, I think.
Absolutely. Have a wonderful time.
Thank you.
That's Al Newsted from Double J, of course. Thank you for joining me on The Conversation Hour. Still some texts coming through about the genre-breaking bands. A David Bowie record changed my music taste forever when I heard it in year 9. That's from one text. The Dixie Chicks introduced me to country music. Yep, absolutely, that as well. Mr. Bungle says, Paul from Gisborne, introduced you to a massive amount of alternative music styles. I'll be looking that up, Paul. And Mochiba Electronic Music is a group that Lois got into. Join me again tomorrow on The Conversation Hour.